Hi, Mage the Podcast listeners. My name is Terry Robinson, and this evening I have the joy of talking with Darling Rose, probably best known from the Midnight Express podcast. Thank you so much for joining us this evening. Our topic this evening, quiets and such, which is arguably the most banal way of talking about mage insanity, but our goal is to do a quick walkthrough of paradox, how that leads into quiet, resonance, synergy, and the various forms that can take when a mage is dealing with the fact that they've tinkered with reality to the point that reality is tinkering back. Paradox is simply the effect that when a mage pushes against the walls of reality, if the mage doesn't have sufficient resources or belief, or the dice just don't agree with the player, paradox can be accumulated. It's more likely to happen with vulgar magic. It's more likely to happen in areas that disagree with the mage's paradigm. And one of the ways this is manifest with a phenomenon known as quiet. This was a kind of mage insanity, but over time that system has become much more developed. And in addition to that, two additional systems have been added. One is resonance and one is synergy. Care to give us a walkthrough of what resonance is and how it appears in gameplay?
There's a slightly different way that this was presented in Mage 20th Anniversary Edition. If I came into the game around Mage Revised, so the revised version was more centered around how each mage has a particular flavor to their magic, where there's traits to how much entropic resonance or dynamic resonance, or whichever trait was most strongly with them. If you were a technocrat, it might be static resonance, was attributed to person's magic. And when they would cast spells, it would leave this kind of aura or imprint upon the world around them or the mage themselves. And depending upon what spheres they were most strong in would be whether or not they had more dynamic resonance or static or entropic resonance. And so that was touched on, I think, Mage Revised. It's around 196 where it talks about paradox. And then it goes on from there into resonance. And it talks about how it affects the mage's magic and how it affects the mage's life. Because once they leave a resonant imprint, even sleepers can notice when a mage's resonance is particularly strong. People notice that there's something weird about that guy over there. And then it goes on into quiet after that.
The history of resonance has kind of changed over time. The first element of it that was introduced was probably, I think, in the original Euthanatos clan book, where the concept of Jor or death taint is introduced. That if a mage were to kill someone using magical effects, or to do so with a certain kind of brutality, or to kill a bunch of people unnecessarily, that would start tainting the magic that the mage did, to the point where maybe at high levels, demons tend to start manifesting around the character whenever they contact umbral entities, or alternatively, they're very bad at maintaining plants. Later in Revised, it was expanded into a full system where you had dynamic, entropic, and static resonances that your character could pick up. That was partially laid out, resonance, in Fallen Tower Las Vegas, which I thought was an interesting place to put it. This was back in the era where the game shot out like 10 books a year, and sometimes sections wouldn't quite make it into the right place. My players avoid paradox like champs. They go for the subtlest way of accomplishing something humanly possible. They are vastly more afraid of paradox than I wish they were. And it's just not something that's really come up for me. What's your experience been with players picking up resonance?
I would mainly play certain characters. For a long time, I was playing a Euthanatos. And for those that know me on Midnight Express, I've mentioned crossover before. We haven't quite gotten into that episode where I get to sink my teeth into the pros and cons of running crossover. I know a lot of people don't like to run crossover games. But this is the experience that I was learning how to get into certain things, because sometimes your mage runs into things that they're just not prepared to really handle as much as they'd like to think they are. This also applies like when they're interacting with each other, different paradigms and everything can really clash. And then you get into the paradox, and the more paradox accumulates between even mages, it can cause quiets too.
So when you're saying resonance tends to pick up in cases where mages are running into other paradigms, is it the case where I have someone who's a modern day pagan, I have a different character that is more technocratic, and the interfaces of their two paradigms are going to make resonance more likely to manifest, or something else?
Resonance or paradox?
Resonance.
Resonance. It would be like a differentiation, again, from my understanding from Mage Revised, the different flavors of what they were trying to work and how Magi would give each other paradox based upon whether or not they could suspend their belief in what they were seeing other mages do. If a virtual adept is watching a verbena grow plants and the virtual adept is like, that's not right, that's not how you're supposed to do that, then the virtual adept would get paradox.
This is a case where one tradition is kind of acting as vulgar to another.
It's covered in the paradigm section as to how your mage believes the world works and how magic works. Really has an effect on how they garner paradox, which is why when Magi see marauders who have gone insane working magic without any paradox, the paradox tends to transfer to the mages that witness this and go, wait, that's not right. Oh, crap. They suddenly get the penalty that the marauder does not for how they're reshaping reality.
Yeah, one of the terrifying aspects of marauders are their ability to, one, use effects to purposefully generate paradox, and two, and then to shed that off to nearby other awakened folk. And it can be pretty nuts. And it gives you this perverse incentive for a marauder to try a nearly impossible effect, knowing that they will likely botch it, to just generate 12 points of paradox, which is certainly enough for a paradox spirit to come and kind of ruin your day.
And but everybody else around them at the time.
Oh, yes. The sleepers will be largely unaffected. Luckily, they'll be in the marauder's insanity bubble for most of that. Mm-hmm. So,
which mages can also slip into if they're not careful.
Boy, howdy.
So. Yeah, I think we're jumping ahead of ourselves a little bit here because marauders definitely have an effect on marauders are more of the end result of too much quiet in some cases. But the way the paradigm is linked to paradox and the resonance of noticing the different traits of magic between their similarities and differences, if they're too different, then you're going to start generating paradox. The resonance traits help. Describe. They're more descriptors. So when I was working with crossovers, I would definitely have to rely on those descriptors heavily in order to get across to the other players to understand what the mage magic feels like or tastes like or smells like or visually how it's described. While I was playing with other mages, it really wasn't much of a big deal unless they were investigating some sort of crime where they had to figure out if another mage had done it and see if their magic signature was left behind at the scene.
So in the campaigns that you ran, are you saying that you leaned on resonance traits as a descriptor to non-mages, or that when dealing with other night folk, resonance was more likely to pop up?
Both. The other supernaturals would definitely have an effect on whether or not the mage would get paradox based upon whether or not they could believe, whether they counted as witnesses, enlightened witnesses, or vulgar witnesses to the effect that's going on.
Oh, okay. It sounds like, to me, resonance was almost this kind of pre-paradox. That it wasn't quite a point of paradox on your sheet, but just an effect of the world noticing the magic that the character was doing and the characteristics of that kind of working their way into how the character moved about the world.
Yeah. And it was definitely noticeable, say, like if a changeling was the observer, changeling, the mage would affect chimerical reality just by being there. Effects that they were working. Yeah, I had definitely needed help with figuring out, wait, what's banality? How do I know what my mage's banality is? And the cross-translation of what we were figuring out was like, okay, so if the mage is working on something, this is this resonance. It would have this certain effect upon the chimerical reality that the changeling could see. The other supernaturals, like vampire would not care to pay attention to magic. That's just not what their senses are geared towards.
Okay.
A werewolf may be in between. A wraith, it would depend upon whether or not the person at the time was actually in an area where a wraith might be, like a graveyard.
For people in the audience who are not familiar with Changeling the Dreaming, can you give a quick descriptor of what chimerical reality is?
Chimerical reality would be like being able to see the Umbra all the time. So in mage terms, the Umbra is this spirit world that has its own flip side of reality, where everything is spirit, where there's certain manifestations of spirits that are attached to certain areas or emotions. And for Changeling, the Dreaming is their version of that alternate reality, the spirit world. And chimerical reality is full of these chimera spirits that react to the environment that they're in. And it's much more mutable and changeable than the Umbra would be, or the Umbra would be perceived. In our games, it's more of like two words for the same thing. It's a spirit world. The way changelings inhabit it, or the way changelings view it, is constant, whereas everybody else has got to make rolls and peek across or summon spirits with spheres or gifts, whereas changelings are always a part of it and always aware of it.
Okay, so it sounds like for a mage, you would be able to use awareness or another ability to temporarily peek into the penumbra and see one of the three Vidare. Whereas for a changeling, they are always both simultaneously seeing mundane reality and this chimerical reality on top of it that doesn't necessarily map to one of the three Vidare, but seems to be something like it, that is a realm of feeling and emotion and thought and such.
Yes, correct.
Okay.
And driving those systems together is very tricky, but when they work beautifully.
I almost strictly have experience with tabletop, in person, people I have met before, I have probably gone to their wedding, mage the ascension. Your background is vastly more varied. You were mentioning before we started recording on how you felt that doing a asynchronous campaign, maybe over text or something like that, gave different room for resonance versus the tabletop. How would you say that the implementation of resonance is going to differ between a bunch of people sitting around a table or maybe on Discord versus a more text-based medium?
I find that it really depends on how comfortable other people are in writing. And when I first got into it, it was much more like chat room text messages. You tend to write one or two lines, but then I actually met some people who would write some beautiful paragraph descriptions. They were much more of a story type of writing than, you know, quick texts, you know, shorthand, maybe one or two expressions. So that kind of raised the bar for me, and I've developed my writing since then to be much more of not so much the thesaurus bashing purple prose, but the quick to the point action, reaction and description, so that I would hand off a lot of the, like, a picture is worth a thousand words. Well, I would have to be trying to paint a brief picture of what my character is doing, saying, sometimes thinking, and the expression in order to get across what they're doing in an imaginary sense. Since I don't have pictures and I can't, like, read the facial expression of the person across the table from me. So now I do live with some of the people that I would game with. So if there was, like, any need for clarification, I'd probably just wait until I got home from work and go, hey, so that other scene that we were doing, where was that again? Or there was something that I needed clarification on, I would ask them in person and they would be able to tell me, and I'd be like, oh, okay, go back to writing the paragraph with more information that I wouldn't necessarily get from being on text. So it was like in character, out of character of how things would be, like across a tabletop or in a LARP.
So it sounds like that was largely the responsibility of the player to make sure that resonance was woven into the effect, or that if a character had two dots of decaying entropic resonance or three dots of percolating dynamic resonance, it was kind of on them to weave that into an effect.
Mm-hmm. And there was also people who would be like the storyteller at the time who would ask about it.
Okay.
If it was, or send direct messages or personal messages, notes saying, check these dots, or does this tell me these dots? Okay, don't forget this. And when they would post next, they would have to include the particular resonance, and it would be on them to describe. But so is role-playing, when you're across from the table and trying to figure out, okay, describe what your person's doing. Oh, you're not going to pay attention to the cop I just described down the street. It's kind of up to the player to take it all in and create a post out of it.
In tabletop, for the few cases where resonance has popped up for me, it's been a thing I would write on an index card and pass to a player and say something to the effect of, remember the next time you cast an effect, that this is how your character's magic is feeling. For me, the best way I had of getting it across was that it is emotion for magic. You can have a conversation with someone and you can be angry, you can be happy, you can be aroused, what have you. Your magic can kind of be the same way, and it is informed by your mood and what you've done in the past. And for me, writing a fiery down on an index card and passing it to a player as a reminder that this is currently the magic space that they are occupying and this is what their effects look like was one of the ways I was able to weave resonance into that. Do you have anything else to say on resonance before we start talking about quiet?
Well, that's a very good way to put it, yeah. And once people get a feel for what their characters are and their magical effects, sometimes they start filling it in for themselves based on the mood of the particular character at the time. So that's a very good way to do it, and I think maybe that's a faster way to do it over a tabletop. And if you're doing it over text, it takes a little longer to describe those things to people and what make them understand what you're going for when you're trying to say, okay, remember your resonance. But once they get a hang of it, they start doing it themselves.
Resonance pops up in, it has kind of been divided into two systems in M20. We have the traditional resonance system, which is, this is the current state of the magic the character is doing. And then they added the system known as synergy, which is the idea of, this is the way the cosmos is influencing the direction of your character. For those who are interested in more information about synergy, that is available in Book of Secrets, which is part of the M20 line, one of the holy trinity, as it were, of games. The notable thing about resonance is it can be taken either as a flavoring agent or as a system. System-wise, when a character casts an effect that is in tune with whatever resonance characteristics they've picked up so far, so if your character has two dots of decaying entropic resonance, if your character were to then use entropy 3 to try and quickly destroy a wooden door, then that effect is going to be easier because it lines up with their resonance. Now, if a character were to try and do the opposite, to use entropy 3 effect to prevent a wooden door from decaying further, you now have dissonance between what the character is trying to accomplish and what their resonance says, and that effect is going to be commensurately more difficult. With the introduction of synergy as a system, you now have two resonance-like systems that can add and subtract from the difficulty. Now, there's always a middle ground between just using it descriptively and using it very crunchy, where on every roll it is checked, to just say, as the storyteller, periodically, your character has built up a certain dynamic or a certain static presence in reality, these effects are going to be slightly easier for you, or these effects are going to be slightly harder for you. Now, for the next section, the discussion of quiet, again, I play not in the world of darkness, but in a world of inky grayness. People by and large are fine, things suck sometimes, but your characters are generally attempting to be good people, making the world a good place. They are the active change makers. So I have literally never had in my 12 years of storytelling a character fall into quiet. Rose, what the dink is quiet?
So quiet, mages are already screwing around with reality. So if they get too far into screwing around with reality, how do they know what reality is? And that's where the first inklings of quiet come in. And they've already got this kind of unstable grip on reality as it is. And let's see, it says a mage can enter quiet when an overwhelming event rocks her psyche. And that's coming from the main book in Mage Revised. So there's lots of things that can qualify as overwhelming event. I mean, if you're going to have a fight between a bunch of different mages and suddenly all the effects start going vulgar, there's going to be a lot of strange stuff warping reality that the mage can or can't handle visually, emotionally, especially. We'll go back and touch on emotionally because there's definitely an investment that mages react to emotionally that can be just a straight track to quiet. And there's, if they ever come across an Afandi or a marauder, so there's lots of these things that can affect mages and their sense of reality that they have to really be aware of when they're combating the technocracy or other, you know, horrible things in the world of darkness or inky blackness, whichever you use. Things just get too much, even if it's just that they're facing the death of a loved one from cancer, and in order to avoid paradox, they can't really do much about it.
So it sounds like we have three large ways in which a character can enter quiet. The first traditional way that a character can enter quiet is just a bunch of paradox all at once, and the storyteller says, well, this is going to manifest itself in the form of quiet. The second one that you outlined is a mage suddenly encountering something within reality that they hitherto thought was impossible. I'm a technomage, and suddenly I encounter this Cthulhu-like entity from beyond the walls of reality, and suddenly I realize maybe I was wrong about a few things. or vice versa, you witness an atomic blast or something ridiculous that you previously didn't think possible. In M20, I think it's referred to as things that man was not meant to know. And then the third one that you bring up is sudden jarring emotional events or some sort of trauma or some sort of incident that befalls the mage personally, that a character that has the ability to tug on the threads of reality is now being stressed. And that is also affecting their already somewhat tenuous cognitive balance. It seems to be the case that once you realize that reality is something that you can muck around with, the normal stability that a lot of people have going through the world is shaken slightly, and madness or other forms of quiet can start creeping in. So are there any cases where you've had characters fall into quiet or had to deal with it? Or what did it look like? Like, is there a scale of severity for quiet? Is it just a person kind of sitting in a chair, staring into the distance? Or how does quiet follow a character around?
Well, in playing the Euthanatos, I definitely had different instances in the online chats where Euthanatos, being aware of quiet and aware of, well, Jor, that he's watching out for it in the mages that he's watching over. And in the game, with all the other mages doing all their crazy other storylines, there was definitely lots of points where these mages ran into things where they just couldn't cope with either the personal tragedy or the PTSD of the hit mark that nearly got them when they were raiding the Technocracy compound or something like that. So there was definitely other games where I was playing a mage, coaching other mages in recognizing their quiets, but it did eventually come to me when I was playing my mage and the mage encountered what he didn't know was a changeling. And the changeling themselves didn't know what they were. He was just trying to foster this thing that seemed to be awakening. And in getting enchanted, he just thought this was a strange paradox effect, but didn't realize that it was warping his sense of reality.
What is enchanting? That is a word that appears in capital letters sometimes when it comes to changeling. So
when a changeling imbues someone else with their power, all the spirit realm that they were able to see before is now transferred to the normal mortal, or in this case a mage, that doesn't normally see this kinds of spirit realm. And now the Euthanatos could see it all the time and just thought, well, this is kind of strange and trippy, and blamed it on paradox effect or drinking too much, and didn't know any better until, and it also lasts a lot longer with mages than with normal people. So the Euthanatos could see all these other spirits. Well, the trouble with being enchanted is all the spirits can see the changeling or the mortal. Once they know they can see each other, they can start affecting each other. And so a particularly nasty spirit attached itself to this mage. It talks about an overwhelming event rocks their psyche. Well, that can definitely qualify when a changeling decides they like you and gives you the blessing of their sight. They think they're being nice, and no, it really isn't sometimes.
So how does that implement itself then in role-playing? So I'm a character that has suddenly become enchanted. I say my character is not inclined towards looking into other realms. Their magic is by and large earthbound. They deal with very simple temporal, in the sense that things that exist and are going on in the world right now affects. They're active in their community. They're part of a cabal that spends most of their time on this side of the gauntlet. And I suddenly gain this other sight and it starts messing with my sense of reality. How is that going to actually, as a player, how is that going to influence the way I then role play?
So that would determine whether or not how banal your mage is. And that's another changeling term. Don't let it frighten you. Now, banality would be how rigid, how stuffy that particular mage is. If they're really stuffy, like say they're a technocrat or a virtual adept, and their way is the best way, and all these other woo-woo ways, nah, that's not going to happen. The enchantment's going to wear off right away. It could be like if a lot of enchantment is pumped into someone who can't handle that kind of thing, then they would immediately go into a type of static quiet where their mind starts to throw up more walls to make the world make more sense. So it'd be like the technocrat that views the Cthulian monstrosity that comes out and suddenly has to reevaluate the way they think of the world. It's one of those moments where their world is shaken and they suddenly have to either reevaluate or try and deny that it's actually happening. And in that denial, they would enter quiet.
The interesting thing here is to note that traditionally in H.P. Lovecraft, when someone sees this other outer god or this faint shadow at the walls of creation, they snap and they go mad. But the thing that's interesting about Mage is the response is largely garnered by the resonance you may have acquired. So rather than responding to this stimulus by going mad, what a technocrat may do is go the other way to buoy their worldview against this. They become more obsessed with order. They become more obsessed with things operating a particular way. That's kind of a notable departure from what some people would anticipate. Obviously, it's your game, your mileage may vary, but the interesting thing about quiet is it is a reflection of the mage and what the mage has going on in their worldview. Now, Rose brought up the idea of a static quiet. Quiet is usually done on a scale of 0 to 6, with 0 being nothing follows you around or modifies your perceptions of the world, and 6 is a marauder, hand your character sheet to your storyteller, and the three forms of quiet that have been introduced since, I think, the first time that popped up was revised. They originally went by the name Madness, Clarity, and Jor for dynamic, static, and entropic quiet, respectively. In modern systems, that is now referred to as madness, denial, and
morbidity.
Morbidity, thank you. Yeah. So you gave an example of denial that a character would come into. You have a technocrat, they have a rigid worldview, they feel that they understand the order of creation. Suddenly they see Yog-Sothoth, and suddenly they find themselves, they have a handful of paradox already, and they're kicked into a level 2 quiet. What is that going to look like? Like, can you give me an idea of what the scale for quiet would be? Like, what a very low-level quiet would be and a very high-level quiet that wouldn't quite be a marauder would be?
I would venture that it would be like the kind of person that turns around and buries themselves in their work. They would retreat to some place where they would get back to what their worldview does.
So suddenly that character has seen this crazy outer darkness. They get back, and the first thing they do is they take literally every warranty card for every home appliance they have ever purchased, and they start filling it out, because that will return order to the universe. Things will make sense again. Yeah, and that's a reasonably good level 2. Level 1, your character has suddenly become a little bit more stubborn, and they start blaming other people. At level 2, your perceptions, you start excluding things from your worldview. At higher levels, you start having a rational behavior. You start having an absolutely fanatical adherence to your ordered system of the world. And at level 5, it's described as being a fanatical drone. So you become a really intense accountant. I'm allowed to say that because I'm an actuary and accountants are our mortal enemies. Have you spent any time with either madness or morbidity?
We have done the madness one before, and that was very interesting to play out, especially if you've got changelings involved. And that's the one probably much more likely to happen if you're doing crossovers with that particular system, or if you're playing crossover where it happens to be with a werewolf, and suddenly things like the delirium start to affect the mage, where they have seen so much horror that they got attacked by a black spiral pack. And all the extra eyes and limbs and deformities of the back spirals was just, yeah, they heard werewolf, but they didn't expect that. And suddenly the madness kind of brings about the everything's an enemy. Everything could be a part of these monsters. So there's paranoia involved. There's lashing out with their own magic in vulgar ways, which just perpetuates more of the cycle of paradox whenever they happen to encounter something that's just not quite right.
So for those of us who consider werewolf a game that is strictly played by people that did lacrosse in college and really enjoy CrossFit, what is delirium? What are the black spiral dancers?
Werewolves are just so huge and terrifying and out of the norm that it would scare normal mortals in this delirium chart that's like starting at 0 with you curl up in a fetal position and you don't remember at all what happened after you saw this thing, to the mid-range is like you run screaming and trying to hide and throw things in the way of the monster so that you can get away. And the 10 is, well, you have no reaction. You are a steel-nerved sharpshooter from Nam, where you have no reaction whatsoever, and you can remember looking directly at a werewolf in their full war form and not be affected.
And that chart is determined, I think, by willpower. So in general, yes, the higher a character's willpower is, the more resilient they're going to be to seeing these crazy things from beyond reality.
Yes. And with mages being will workers, their willpower tends to function on a lot of the same levels. So you kind of assume that being awakened means that they understand more about the world. They have a higher willpower and they might not be affected by, you know, when they hear werewolves are real, they're like, oh, okay. And when they foresee one, they know it for what it is, instead of reacting like a terrified human mortal that curls up and is like, no, doggies are bad.
Just to kind of get an idea, werewolf is notable for physical attributes getting quite high. With significant magics and significant trainings, you might be lucky to get a character with a strength of 6. It is not uncommon to encounter a werewolf in war form with a strength of 9 or 10, especially if they have other things that are enhancing those attributes. For those of you following along at home, that would allow them to trivially bend a large lead pipe or rip a door off the back of a tractor trailer. So I don't know about you, but to me, that usually involves matter and forces effects, and these guys can just like tear a truck in half. And mortals kind of react to that poorly. Within the system, the idea is that mankind was once hunted by werewolves, and genetically we remember that. So when we see it go from good doggy to bad doggy, we respond to that very strongly. And as a storyteller, you have the option of just saying, like, what are you talking about? I have literally met Zeus, and I have the ability to teleport. This is kid stuff to me. Or being like, oh my God, the shit in my pants is shitting its pants, and that needs to change its pants as well. And then you run screaming into the night. So again, these are just
options. Or we tend to say, we suddenly remember we are small and squishy.
Yeah. Oh yeah. It's always amazing to me when people were like, mages would always win in a fight. I'm like, you can't soak egg. What do you think is going to happen? Like literally every tooth in the world of darkness will rip you in half. I will give you the edge if you have the ability to plan and you're allowed to bring friends. But like, yeah, if I don't care how many dots and dough you have, the werewolf is going to win. Likewise, anytime that you run into a vampire with like strength of 9 and 7 dots of celerity and 2 dots of animalism, and like, just save time, get all your characters' character sheets and put them through a paper shredder. Like, it'll just be faster for everyone. Reroll, go on with it.
You can see what I'm talking about, where it is variable upon the storyteller to decide whether or not your mage is going to react to a very traumatic event, especially involving any other supernatural creature, whether they're going to react in the terms of, this is something in the mage universe and I'm going to give it mage stats, or I'm going to borrow things from this book and say that your mage has suddenly been affected in this way with delirium, big D, and tell them to roll on the chart what their willpower is at this moment and match it up and see what their reaction should be. So that in itself might be a way to garner madness quiet, depending on what they react to and how they're reacting, or equivalent, even if it's not a werewolf, even if it is a verbena's reaction to Yogg-Sothoth, and it's like, well, the tree dryad dance was a little hairy, but not quite on this level, and see how well they react to that.
Yeah, it is very easy to roleplay superheroes, characters that are perfectly well-adjusted and are never affected by the outside world. What quiet, whether it be denial, madness, or morbidity, allow you to do is to remind your mages that they are very much indeed mortal. They may be at the top end of human capability. Mortals generally have a willpower between 2 and 5. It's not uncommon to have a mage with a willpower of 7, 8, or 9, but even they, eventually the universe will catch up with them. Mages are playing with forces of the cosmos that are well beyond what a lot of other supernatural systems will even involve. And the avatar doesn't really insulate the mage emotionally from the turmoil and trouble that can be done with reweaving the fabric of reality. So if you're like, oh, my character would never be affected by this, think back to a time in your life where something sudden or something traumatic has happened to you, and realize that before that, you may have considered yourself to be impermeable and unaffected by the world around you. But I don't know about you, I turn into a giant baby if I get less than 7 hours of sleep in the night. So my mage character is eventually going to be affected by the world, and quiet as a mechanism allows you to kind of weave that in. In first edition, quiet was kind of interesting that it seemed to be portrayed as more of a digital state. A character was in or out of quiet, and in systems as they went along, they became much subtler with that, where it is much more reasonable that a mage may have one dot in madness and periodically have minor hallucinations, which you roleplay by slipping your player a card. The person you recently lost due to this supernatural encounter is across the street and waving at you. It can be used very flavorfully to remind your players of their vulnerability and how tenuous their link to reality is, and how much more tenuous that becomes when you start playing with the threads of reality. How has it popped up in your chronicles, Rose?
Well, I've seen since I was playing Euthanatos much more of the Jor. Now, because of these different, the Jor or the morbidity trait would come up more, especially when the mages would go out on some sort of reconnaissance or trying to rescue a compatriot that had been picked up by the technocracy. And they encounter things that they're just not quite prepared for. Say they get into a firefight, and in defending themselves, they actually shot someone in the head. And the mage comes back with horrible guilt about, this is the first time they've ever killed someone, but they were doing it to save someone else. But they don't even know if that other person was the technocrat or just some guard at the facility that has a wife and a pile of kids at home and a family, and they're just eaten up inside with this guilt. And it becomes sort of like this superpowered PTSD that the mage is trying to cope with their actions. And it wasn't even magical at the time. But because a lot of the mage's mental stability is so reliant on how they perceive reality and work their magic, this event that happened to them, that they were a part of, suddenly has this emotional toll on them, where they're questioning themselves a lot. They're questioning their own judgment, and it may seem like much more of a morality kind of crutch. At least I've seen it mentioned like they didn't like using Jor or morbidity in the mage game because it imposes morality on a character that's supposed to be able to do all these fantastical things. But it's like, well, that's still up to the character to decide. There's other Euthanatos, or there's other mages that don't care. And there was definitely other people in the group that was like, it was you or them, which would you prefer?
This is interesting because you are presenting almost the flip side of how morbidity is traditionally portrayed. When Jor was initially rolled out, Jor was acquired when you accidentally shot that guard in the head and didn't care. Mm-hmm. It was a case of your character had grown numb to the forces of morbidity.
That would be the start of like, okay, so maybe they get one point in Jor because eventually they believe their other friends and they get over it. But it was in how they dealt with those feelings that suddenly changed them, how they dealt with that change. If suddenly they turn around and go, okay, I'm never going to touch any gun again, I'm never going to harm another living thing, suddenly they're crippling themselves in how effective they can be in a game, especially World of Darkness. The next wave of things that come at them, what are they going to do? Go hide? Because they don't want to kill anything? They don't want to hurt anything? So it comes back to like how the mage reacts to the traumatic experience, the emotional traumatic experience, whether or not that gives them Jor, or whether or not they deal with it in a healthy way, and whether or not they start using it with their magic, whether or not they're healing people that they can't stand to see sick. But now they were made this elevated miracle and they couldn't handle the stress. And then the mage feels that's their fault. So it comes back again to how the mage deals with what they do, the consequences of their own actions when they involve magic in the lives of other people.
Now, system-wise, this can be represented that a player is going to be aware of the fact that their character's perceptions aren't necessarily meshing with reality. And in M20, you have the option to blow a point of willpower to roll your willpower against difficulty quiet plus 3 or quiet plus 5 or whatever you deem to be the appropriate level. I think the default is quiet plus 5. And if you garner 3 or more successes for that scene, you're allowed to ignore the effects of it. And that can be useful because it can give your character a space to heal. So that's what this is going to look like from a, let's say, a crunch perspective, when you just kind of need to have the ability to to roll your way through.
You need the downtime to fill in downtime with such and such event because your mage has such and such, then they succeeded the roll. So this is going to be your downtime time filled in with this, and wipe it off your sheet when you come back to the next game.
Okay. At this point, we have done a basic walkthrough of how paradox and synergy and resonance can lead to quiet, what those different quiets can look like, how they can be interpreted. Is there any additional commentary you'd like to have on that? For instance, have you ever used a hobgoblin, which is an example of where someone's quiet is made manifest and literally starts running around in the world?
No, not quite. I haven't used a hobgoblin, though. In our crossover kind of discussion between mage and changeling, I helped a friend of mine write a crossover page for reference when we were bantering back and forth, and it's got book reference material for both systems. When we got to hobgoblins, we're like, okay, so one would manifest in reality, but imagine how many chimerical hobgoblins might be lurking around, you know, giggling and laughing and waiting for the mage to cross over into a quiet mindscape. That would be definitely very scary and interesting, and kind of up the terror factor for the mage who's having the quiet, or the changelings who are noticing that there's this crazy person over here with some powers, and there's a whole lot of hobgoblins that are running around and making life miserable for us. What do we do about that? So it's been something that we've had on the table of wanting to use, and we've got certain ideas on how to use it, but I have not yet used it in a game direct.
Now, you made mention to a mindscape. What is a mindscape?
A mindscape would be when the quiet gets so strong that the mage is pretty much in their own little bubble of reality. And that's getting very close to how the marauders start to manifest, although their bubble of reality begins stretching and encompassing everybody else's reality. It's when the quiet gets so strong that they pretty much retreat into their own mind, and the mage becomes comatose, and they're pretty much like dreaming magic. At this point, they play out their reality over and over in their head of how it's safe there. It makes sense to them there.
And this can be done either voluntarily or involuntarily. When you've run it, has it been mostly a case where a character enters a mindscape to try and deal with something, or just where their level of quiet has kind of reached a level where the mage's magical immune system has kicked into place and they're kind of dumped into their own private Idaho?
That's a good way of putting it. In mine, the one time my Euthanatos hit a mindscape, it was partially the changeling chimera that had latched onto him, pulled him across the shroud, and that wasn't voluntary, but once he was in this pocket, he was like, well, this is mine now. Welcome to my nightmare. He dealt with his things in his own little mindscape, and the changeling had to get into it and pull him back out, but his mortal body was kind of physically sleeping. Essentially, his mind had been pulled out of himself. And that was not terribly voluntary, but it was trying to, again, straddle the compromise between these two systems of what would happen. It was very interesting in that which parts was the command of the changeling system and which parts was the command of the mage system. In the mindscape, it was completely the mage making it his own. So his madness portrayed out on the walls and how he visualized his own mental state. And everybody else had to run around in it. And it was more like, I guess, The Cell, if you've ever watched that.
So the idea is, in the movie The Cell, there is this technology that was created for therapeutic purposes that would allow a psychonaut, as it were, to explore the imaginative space of another person in an attempt to communicate someone who may otherwise be locked in from the outside world or is having difficulty communicating, maybe because they're young or they're mute or otherwise there's something preventing them from normal communication. So it sounded like your example of a mindscape kind of went both ways, that a character was using it defensively, pulled a problematic element from chimerical reality into their mindscape in an attempt to deal with it, and eventually they had to be rescued from that by the changeling. So systems-wise, there's a few rules on how to help deal with this. Usually some combination of prime and mind, usually at four dots and above, a lot of willpower checks to kind of help a character navigate this. But was yours more crunchy, or was it mostly just role-playing?
It was a little crunchy when there were items that we weren't quite sure which way it should go, so we crunched the numbers. But other times, mainly it was for the flavor of the role-play. It's like, okay, when you can't decide on what to use, you do what makes for the best story.
Okay.
And so that's what we went through.
I run a troop game where there are six of us, one storyteller and five players. If one of my players were to fall into quiet at a pretty high level, how as a storyteller, do you have any recommendation on how I can keep the other players involved in that as a player is dealing with trauma or with being stuck in a mindscape?
It might be difficult for the rest of the group to realize that this friend of theirs has not woken up in the morning, that they would have to figure out whether or not they had the right mind spheres to try and attempt to reach their friend, or whether or not they have spirit or prime to tell whether or not they're actually in a quiet mindscape. So once they do establish that, how do they get in? And that would require its own mind spheres. Or do they just leave whoever can't get in behind to take care of the body, make sure it's clean, make sure it doesn't stop breathing, have everybody else go in on the adventure? As a storyteller, that'd be like really hard to like split up your group. So depending on the level of the quiet and how strong the mindscape is, maybe have everybody share a dream with one person that can get in on it.
Okay.
In on the mindscape. Or there's also the risks that they could go mad too.
So it sounds like the option you're presenting is something akin to Inception, where I have one character that is able to make it in. That character creates a mental link with the rest of the group, kind of acts as an anchor point. We all hop into Bob's delusion, and now we have this role-playing session that is us helping Bob deal with whatever. And that's mostly going to be a role-playing more so than a systems question.
When you're dealing with everybody in the mindscape trying to help out Bob's delusion and help them deal with it, there's also the likelihood of those other mages garnering their own paradox and quiets in having to deal with the subconscious realm they're having to fight through to get to Bob and deal with his delusion. There could be the mindscape as a separate element and the paradox spirit, because the paradox can actually generate its own spirit to come and spank the mage for messing around with reality. And the other mages around that particular target are not immune to getting attacked by the paradox spirit itself. So there's different ways that you could play this on the table, whether or not you want to split up your group or put everybody into the Inception style. Everybody goes into the mindscape to try and rescue Bob out of it.
And I guess at the simplest level, you kind of wind up using a system that is similar to a character slipping into a coma. That if role-playing a mindscape is not a place that your characters are comfortable, that you wind up using quiet kind of as a cosmic timeout. Your character is insensate and unresponsive for some period of time. The paradox bleeds off. Your character wakes up. Everything is magically dealt with. So if you're like me and you're terrified fundamentally with the emotional ramifications of the world of darkness, and you like everything to be slightly more pink tinged, then that is a backup option. Rose, thank you so much for talking with us about one of the most flavorful and unique aspects of Mage, the notion of quiet, how it kind of acts as a morality system for Mage that otherwise may not have one. Where can our listeners find more about the work that you're doing, or are there any projects that you would like to plug?
Well, you can always find me over on the Facebook groups. I'm over there under my actual name. But the thing that I like to plug most is always that I am a part of the Midnight Express, and we love having people come post their questions and listen to your podcasts and tell us what you'd like to hear us cover next. So I know we've got over 50 episodes, so I welcome anybody to come catch up on those, and I'm in quite a few of them.
What is the topicality of it? This is Mage the Podcast. We talk about Mage and Mage crossovers. We're pretty narrow. Midnight Express sounds like a reference to Wraith, but does it encompass more than that?
It does. We cover all classic World of Darkness and we tend to review the supplements. We review all the books. So when it comes to reviewing the books, or we'll take a Shard of Darkness where we review one particular topic like the Knights of the Cold Watch or the Hemgar Sobek or one particular guild of the Sandmen, it's got a lot of different varieties. Sometimes we do interviews with the other people that are on the show. So we're still experimenting with what all our content encompasses, but mainly it is book reviews for all classic World of Darkness.
And if you want to listen to a fascinating podcast every 8 weeks, Midnight Express is perfect for you.
We're working on getting enough podcasts recorded so that it's more than that. But yes, our output schedule is a little funky, but that's why we keep referring people to keep listening, keep coming back to it. You hear something a little bit each time.
Where... And it's one of those things where I think no two of your hosts are on the same continent, it seems. So yeah. That feels like podcasting set to hard mode.
That's the other reason we're having trouble recording, is that our hosts are all across the globe. So we try and make sure that we have enough time for everybody.
Well, awesome. Thank you so much for talking. And we look forward to talking to you again in the future.
All right. Thank you so much for having me, Terry.